CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be talking to Kim Ives, who is the editor of Haiti Liberté. And Kim spoke on December 21st to the United Nations Security Council about this issue of the crisis in Haiti and how it might be addressed by an international body. So it should be very pertinent, since Canada allegedly has a leading role. I really doubt it, but anyhow, that's what the claim is. And later in the show, we will be talking to the bluesologist Norman Otis Richmond, and we'll be taking up the memory of Martin Luther King, because this is the time when King is most discussed in across North America, and I just saw a piece about Martin Luther King regarding his views on the Vietnam War and how decisive his intervention was as a leader of the civil rights movement in America to link the issue of racial equality to the matter of militarism, money for planes, money for bombs, but no money for impoverished Americans, but particularly Black Americans, who at that time had still did not have voting rights in large segments of America. So it's always pertinent to talk, particularly now, because we're hearing, I'm sure Canadian listeners think about this, we're right at the same situation where we're talking about how important it is to have fighter planes, American fighter planes, I think it's called the F-35, without which, of course, Canada would cease to exist, they tell us. And a lot of money goes into that. And meanwhile, we're told we can't have other things. I believe we're joined now by Kim Ives. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am, Phil. I'm here.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time. You're the editor.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Canadians need to hear your voice, because you were speaking, and frankly, the whole world heard about this. You spoke at the United Nations Security Council meeting on December 21st. You had just been, by the way, in Haiti. You had visited in November of 2022, I gather. And here in Canada, the dialogue has been, and certainly in the media, Haiti really needs our help, and what form that help should take. And the main talk is about military intervention, although our diplomats are lately kind of tempering expectations. But really, my understanding is, and from your speech, a wonderful speech, by the way, that this is not such a popular idea in Haiti, and I don't think it's a popular idea, very popular idea in Canada. Talk about this matter. You said in your speech that solutions can't be found any longer, if they ever could have been, through foreign intervention. If that's the case, why are the United States, Canada pushing this?
Well, it's like the old adage, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? And so, you know, the U.S. Has been using the United Nations as its guardian of the empire, really, for the past 30 years or so. The old formula used to be, we'd put in a tin horn dictator, a Pinochet, a Batista, Somoza, Duvalier, whoever. Mm-hmm. But the problem was, these guys were corrupt. They were very brutal. They created a lot of Che Guevara's. And, you know, it was a problematic situation. So the better the improved situation was, you know, we used what Edward Herman called demonstration elections, basically like in the U.S. and Canada. Mm-hmm. Candidate with the most money wins, and then if they get in trouble, we send in the international peacekeeping force to make things right, because the whole world is against, you know, whatever uprising is happening against the neoliberal politician who got into power. Mm-hmm. Well, Haiti was the first country to really mess with that formula in 1990 when it elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In 1991, the U.S. went about it the new fashion. Well, it was kind of a mixture of the two. They first used the old army to take him out and crush resistance, but then they brought in the international peacekeepers, and they did it again in 2004. So the U.N. has become the international proxy for U.S. capitalism and Canadian and French as well, primarily in Haiti, where, of course, as you surely know, Canada has interests in mining and banking and so forth. They've done this really for the past 30 years. I remember back in the 90s, in the first occupation, when the Canadians were brought in, they were coming in. It was kind of a tag team, right? The U.S. was the bad cop, and the Canadians were the good cop. Now they've kind of changed roles. Now the Canadians, just like they do in the world wrestling, you know, shows, you know, they switch. Now the Canadians are the bad cop, and the Americans are the good cop. You know, the Americans are sitting back, and they're letting Canada do all the heavy lifting up front. So, but, you know, of course, Canadians can't do it all. They really need some blackface, and, you know, Justin Trudeau's attempts didn't really work in the past. So now they're going to Jamaica and Bahamas and Kenya and Ghana and trying to find others who, you know, will come and sort of put a little coffee in the milk. So that's basically the formula they're working at the UN. It's not working very well. They're trying to do this thing where, you know, usually the international peacekeeping force is under the control of the UN. That means it's under the control of the Security Council. Mm-hmm. But really, since February of this year, they've had a big problem because now the old unipolar world isn't there anymore. Suddenly, China and Russia are standing up to the U.S. and they're saying, "Listen, you can't just use the U.S. as your handmaiden, you know, to do your things. We're not going to take that." So this is where, you know, they're trying a kind of a half measure where they're saying, okay, it's not going to be the UN that's doing it. We're going to deputize somebody. We're going to outsource it, you know, to another country. Canada will maybe take the lead in that, or maybe they'll make Jamaica the lead. I don't know. But, you know, they're trying to find some formula. And basically when I went there, I threw a rock in the whole thing because they said, listen, the Haitians don't want any foreign intervention at all, and they know perfectly well who's behind it, which is mainly Washington. And so this is the situation we're facing, where, you know, we're facing that first line of defense, trying to make it so they don't have the UN's benediction to go into Haiti and do the same mischief and mess that, and I shouldn't say it so lightly, I mean crimes. They just did terrible, terrible things in these past two interventions. And, you know, the Haitians are saying we don't want it anymore.
Yeah, they've had that nightmare that the UN came and ended up, it was bringing cholera. And then there's the issue of paying soldiers from other countries who turn out to have rather bad habits when they find out that they can exercise authority. By this time, I suppose in a way it's surprising. It's taken so long for the headwinds to start coming at the United Nations. Where you mentioned Russia, China, others are starting to say, actually, we'd like some accountability from you folks who claim you're helping. Because right. A lot of money goes into helping, but the Haitian people seem to be getting poorer and more oppressed.
Right, exactly. And that was, of course, one of the points I made at the thing was you're saying you have to raise the price of or remove subsidies on gas and hence raise the price of gas because it's costing the government $400 million a year to underwrite the gas price, which, you know, fuels the tap taps and the public buses and all the things that Haitians use to get around because they're, you know, not that a lot of people don't have cars and so forth. Well, the cost of the U.S. last U.S. intervention was on the order of $600 million a year. So, you know, why are you going to spend $600 to save $400 million? Precisely the point. Why can they be sending $105 billion to Ukraine and they can't find $3 billion, $2 billion for Haiti? So this is just it. I mean, once again, it's the arms industry. It's the various interests who run the society who make a killing when you have these peacekeeping operations in countries like Haiti.
You know, you put your speech, you put your finger right on that matter. You pointed out that it was Prime Minister Henry who decided to reduce subsidies from fuel. But you also noted that the Americans said, that's what we wanted. So the Americans wanted that to create a, for them, this part has to do with this concept of austerity programs for the poor all over the world from the U.S. And that led directly to the phenomenon that we're hearing about all the time here, which is roadblocks, which, by the way, I think could happen anywhere in the world when you double the price of fuel. That could happen in Toronto where people would have roadblocks. And then they immediately label people who spontaneously react to being robbed. They call them gangs. And I was very happy you put your finger on this issue because we have raised it on this program. Why are we using this word, these gangs? Unless we're going to be very specific who we're talking about, it's just a pejorative and it's easy to apply to black people, frankly.
Exactly. And as I was speaking to one of your colleagues Robin Philpott over in Montreal earlier today, and he was raising it. He was saying this G9 Federation, which is the one they sort of...
you say they're the only one that is named, actually.
Right, the only one that's named. And they're the ones who are really at war with the bad gangs, that is, the criminal gangs. The G9 are the ones saying, you know, we against your criminality, stay out of our areas. So they've been having very fierce battles for 2 or 3 years, but they're not targeting the criminal gangs. They're targeting the gangs fighting the criminal gangs. And so it's very similar to the Black Panthers here in the United States. I imagine some Canadians, and or at least Canadians of a certain age, will remember the Panthers. And, you know, here was a movement which came out of the ghettos, came out of the bidonville of the United States, and they were, you know, building schools, asking for health care, trying to do all sorts of measures to uplift their community, and yet they were painted as criminals, as bandits. I mean, the same thing for Pancho Villa in Mexico, the same thing, you know, after the talk at the UN, the Kenyan ambassador came up to me and said, wow, you were really brutal. And I said, well, listen, I didn't say to him, but I kind of wished afterwards that I had. I wanted to say the Mau Mau in Kenya back in the 60s, yes. The British treated them as bandits.
Equivalent of terrorists. And,
exactly.
And as you mentioned, of course, Villa, he had to be the bandit. And no Hollywood movie can be made about him without portraying him as a crazed bandit.
Right, exactly. So this is it. Yes, like you said at the very beginning, the people are made to be the criminals, so we're saving the people from themselves.
And by the way, now, they you were criticized because they said, oh, well, you spoke of the G9 group. But, and this was something I had raised, I have to say, on the program. I was so glad that you, someone who actually knows about it, that I saw the reference that one of the leaders of G9 was a former ranking police officer, which immediately occurred to me that I don't think you should call such a person a gang leader. This is somebody with training who has some kind of coherent outlook. Why don't you just address him, actually, first of all, by asking him questions or saying what's on his mind, as opposed to just smearing him with the word gang leader.
Right. That's the mildest one they use. You know, they call him a massacre, a murderer, a killer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. No.
His name, by the way, is Chernier, or is that it?
Cherizier, Jimmy Cherizier. Mm-hmm. But he, as a little kid growing up in the streets of Port-au-Prince, his mother sold barbecued meat, sold grilled meats in the street, and there were three Jimmys in his neighborhood, and to distinguish between them, they called him Jimmy Barbecue, because that's what his mom did.
Uh-huh.
She gave each Jimmy a...
They put a sinister spin on that one.
Well, exactly, yeah. So that became, they call him Barbecue because he burns people alive, you know, this kind of thing, which is just, you know, ridiculous. And, you know, but people get taken in. I mean, we were taken in, Phil. We, at Haiti Liberté, you know, where we've been around the block a few times, and we got lazy and sort of in the beginning were drinking the Kool-Aid. We said, oh, okay, so he's the new Toto Constant, who was a death squad leader back in the 90s, or Guy Philippe, who was a death squad leader or led the rebels, who were a form of death squad against Aristide in the coup of 2004. So we just said, okay, so this is the new bad guy. And then one day my director sat me down and he said, listen, you've got it all wrong. This guy is something serious. He's an interesting guy, and we got to go check it out. So we started to do the research. I went down and met with him, and I came back, told my director. I said, man, you were 100% right. Uh-huh. And then after Jovenel was assassinated on July 7th of last year, I went down with Dan Cohen of Uncaptured Media. He was with Mint Press News at the time. And before going down, he said to me, Kim, listen, you know, I respect your years of work around Haiti, but I can't say I'm going to agree with you. Well, now he's, as they say in Creole, more royalist than the king. And, you know, is totally seen, you know, exactly what Jimmy Cherizier and the G9 are trying to do. I mean, Jimmy Cherizier, yeah, he was a star cop. He wasn't that high ranking. He was, I mean, he was a kind of a team leader of an UDMO unit, which is a specialized unit basically for putting down gangs and criminality. And but, you know, an operation went badly in the Grand Ravine neighborhood of Port-au-Prince, and the police leadership said, we have to find a scapegoat. It was Jimmy Cherizier, but they picked the wrong guy to stick a knife in the back of.
Yeah, and by the way, you raised another very important matter. It seems to me Canada, and certainly the U.S., when they talk about, well, we have to help, you know, the only basis for this is a prime minister who you say is not popularly elected, and he's not popular.
Right. And,
I get the impression that we're hanging by our last prime minister, or by a lone prime minister who is not legitimate, that beyond him there doesn't seem to be anybody. And yet on his word, we're supposed to and are providing armored vehicles as of today.
Yeah. Well, in 1915, Phil, there was a U.S. intervention, and they did kind of a similar thing. They intervened, and then they told the parliament to get together, and they had the parliament elect a puppet, a guy called Sudar Tiganov, and then Sudar Tiganov said, okay, U.S. troops, you can stay. This time they did it kind of the opposite way. They selected their guy beforehand because it was the core group, this group of ambassadors, which basically is under the direction of Washington and of Canada and France. It includes also England and Spain and Brazil and so forth at this time. I'm not sure if they'll kick out Brazil now that Lula's in. Lula, I hope, has been schooled by his experiences of the past decade. But the point being that, they basically installed a puppet, and then they had their hand puppet ask them, can you come and save me? And, now, they're using that as their excuse.
Yeah, but it's a narrow base to try to do anything from. You point out that in your speech that one of the American ambassadors talked about we should sideline Mr. Moyes. Well, he really got sidelined.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah,
and that a lot of people would like to know. Well, what is the role of these guys in suits? Mr. Ray, for example, white hair, very distinguished. But, they're not very savory. I saw you, I'm remembering now, on Amy Goodman talking about WikiLeaks some time back revealed just how much, when you look at the way they talk privately, they're somewhat like gangsters themselves.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. At the meeting, there were the 15 Security Council members, and then there were three other countries, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Canada, who were invited to be there because I guess they are principals concerned, right? So in all the, there were six countries who made no reference to my speech. Most of the countries began, we thank Mr. Kim Ives for his note, or we take note of what Mr. Ives said, or blah, blah, blah. But there were six countries who said nothing, who didn't, mention it like I wasn't there. It was the Dominican Republic, Haiti, England, France, the U.S., and Canada. And two of them actually took issue with me, not directly, obliquely. They didn't mention my name, but the Haitian foreign minister who came to New York for this meeting, Jean Genius, an old friend of mine, but now not so much, said that I was doing marketing for the gangs. But the guy who really took the gloves off mostly was Bob Ray. And he spoke extemporaneously. Almost everybody else had a kind of a written speech, prepared before the meeting that they just read. But he was talking directly with me, and he basically said, I was talking nonsense, and that, we will never, we will do everything to fight people who kill and so forth. I mean, I don't know what he thinks the Canadians will be doing, that they don't kill people. I mean, was a really very aggressive, and I read a couple of days later Eve Engler's piece about Bob Ray, saying that he was an arrogant SOB, and sure enough, I got to sort of experience it firsthand.
Yes, well, he's a Rhodes Scholar, and you mustn't cross a Rhodes Scholar because...
Oh, okay.
That's the ultimate... he makes sure that people are reminded, although I wouldn't want Rhodes associated with my name.
Right, I know, Rhodesia, after all. Jesus, yeah. Yes, Jesus.
Well, I don't hear any of these people insisting there be a popular election. They're going to intervene, they're going to help out, they're going to bring order. I saw the word normal, and you say, normal? Haiti? you had an elected president, part of the most popular in modern history.
Yeah,
and
right.
he may as well be a ghost. I don't see anybody refer, but my understanding is the party Lavalas is still not permitted to run.
They did participate in the last two elections. Not Aristide, but a woman called Maryse Narcisse. They didn't do very well because, there was a lot of... shall we say, mischief with those elections. And I think that, the results are very difficult to know what they actually were. So, but in any case, a lot of people were very devoted to Aristide himself.
Yes.
But not so much maybe to the party, even
well,
though
that would have to be the case. I found him a conundrum. But there is no actual broad test. There have been calls for an election this year. In your speech, you said that is not likely to happen. And certainly I'm not hearing it from any of the Canadian political leaders or U.S., and they don't seem to be anxious to have an election.
Yeah, well, no, it's the U.S. Is changing horses, even though they're doing it very sneakily and under the radar. From the Ariel Henry group, which is called the Mousseau Accord, given for the place there, coalition's unity documents were signed, and another group called the Montana Accord. Now, the Montana Accord is more the bourgeoisie éclairée, the, you know, enlightened bourgeoisie who know how to sort of package it a little better. They talk about being Haitian-led, and this is the big new slogan, Haitian-led. But it's baloney, you know, it's just a slogan. Mm-hmm. And the U.S., diplomats are all starting to push it. This Montana Accord, the Council on Foreign Relations, kind of the ruling class, the U.S. ruling class's most important foreign policy think tank, had a big piece saying, yeah, we got to go with Montana Accord. So they're just looking how and when to do it. You know, it's always dangerous switching horses because it can open up an opportunity for revolution to pop out. And that's their biggest fear, is that Haiti is a tinderbox, and they just don't want the whole thing to blow up on them when they're trying to transition from one to the other. So all of this is to say that this Montana group says we're going to need at least 2 years to have elections, at least two. This is probably more likely if the transition is done. And there's no guaranteeing of that because Haiti is in a very revolutionary situation.
It seems so, and I assume they like the 2 years so that they can create a new model of how to do this.
Right.
A word I didn't throw out was, it's in today's Globe and Mail and Toronto Star are saying, well, now we're going to sanction various elites. And that word, of course, is, well, obviously we should sanction elites. That seems to be the conclusion. But who are they to decide who the elite is? It works with the public to say, oh, well, that's an elite, so we're going to sanction them. But who are they talking about? And why, other than public relations, what are they accomplishing?
Well, yeah, that's just it. They're trying to, they know that the people are distrustful and very skeptical of their so-called help, and rightly so, of course. So they're saying, okay, we got to make some, in baseball, you have baseball in Canada too, right? You know, you have the sacrifice play.
Yes.
So they're having to sacrifice a couple of people so they can get the home run, you know, get the troops in. So, you know, they're picking and choosing a few of them. Now, you know, practically you'd have to indict the entire Haitian bourgeoisie, you know. But, you know, sometimes the things are, how could I say, quite arbitrary. I see some of the first sanctions they put out, supposedly because they're supporting gangs. Now, sanctioned Michel Martelly, Laurent Lamothe, and Jean-Robert Seyant, the president from 2011 to 2016. Lamothe was his prime minister for four of those years, and then Seyant was a prime minister for Jovenel Moïse. Now, Martelly, okay, it's pretty clear. His brother-in-law is a guy called Charles Saint-Remy, who has just also been, I think, sanctioned by Canada, known as Kiko. this guy is pretty much well known to be a drug trafficking kingpin, you know, took over basically a drug trafficking operation that used to be run by other drug traffickers. Anyway, he's quite renowned for it, and they're certainly in all kinds of criminal gang dealings. But Pour La Motte and Seyant, you know, even if politically one might not agree with everything they did, but I don't think that they were doing that much gang dealings. On the contrary, I think they were sort of a different ilk. So I think a lot of it's political, you know, who has, I don't know, is it Trudeau who's making these decisions? You know, is it his advisors who are telling him? I know he has a number of Haitian advisors. You know, are they saying, okay, let's take out, you know, this? So, yes, it's not something that can be done lightly. And I know the ambassador to the UN for Gabon is the one heading it. They put him in because he was supposed to be the most neutral. And I know he's very, very anxious not to go and sanction people who are not truly guilty. And, of course, Canada's sanctions are a different kettle of fish, and they were called to task by the Russians at the meeting for saying, you know, why are you doing this unilaterally? We're supposed to be going through the Security Council. But clearly the U.S. and Canada have in mind that they're doing their own thing. They're going to try to get it out of the UN, get the benediction out of the UN, but
that's where Henry comes in, right? They can say Henry asked us.
Right. Well, Henry did ask the UN, and he asked in general, right? The world, but he went to the UN to ask for it. But it looks like the US and Canada are kind of figuring, we're not going to get this through the Security Council. Russia or China are going to block our ability to get troops. So I think Trudeau is trying to get ahead of the game and is starting to, you know, mete out these sanctions in an effort to win over the people. So
he's doing something.
Doing something, and he's on our side. And look, he is taking on the bourgeois. He's not just, because when you put sanctions on some gang leader, it doesn't do much. They don't have international bank accounts. They're not traveling internationally. Yes. You know, as they say in French, you know, it's a sword thrust into water.
Yes. By the way, we're speaking to
Kim Ives.
Yeah. I'm getting there. Kim Ives. Yeah. And of course, editor of AT Liberté. And I'm so glad you
the English section, Phil. The English section only. I'm just the English section editor.
In English. By the way, it's a great site. I hope people will go to that. And also, I hope everyone will read the speech. I think you have stirred things up. And I know a lot of ambassadors were very happy you were there, just as there were some who were unhappy. But I have to ask you a couple of questions more, if you don't mind. I'd like to know, Dominican Republic always seems that there's a dark history to that island. And the Dominican Republic seems to be on side with the Americans. But can you talk about what their role has been here in the last period, this period?
Well, you know, it seems history always deals out things sort of in pairs. I mean, as we know, you have Nicaragua and Honduras, right? And Nicaragua, who has this, you know, revolution that happened, and Honduras was used as sort of the counter-revolutionary base for sending in Contras, etc. Well, the same is true between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Haiti was, you know, of course, this seminal revolution, which changed all history. It was the beginning of the end of chattel slavery and colonialism. It was Haiti, which was the touchstone for the revolutions on the continent. They supported Miranda and Bolivar. And if you look in the flags of the northern South American countries, you'll always see the Haitian flag. The red and the blue of the Haitian flag is in there. And then they have a band of yellow, I guess, to represent the peoples of those countries. So Haiti had this incredibly revolutionary role. So the Dominican Republic was always seen, I think, by the powers as a kind of a bulwark against the Haitians, you know. And Haiti did occupy or had freed the whole island. By the way, the entire island of Hispaniola, which was named Hispaniola by Columbus, was called Haiti by the Arawak Indians who were there, who Columbus found there, meaning mountainous land. But so all of Haiti was called Haiti from 1804 till, till 1844, when they were basically driven out in the Dominican Republic as the ignominious reputation of being the only country in world history who has chosen to go back into colonial status, which they did briefly after freeing themselves, quote-unquote, from the Haitians. Now, sure, okay, the Haitian occupation, I'm not saying there weren't any excesses. I haven't studied it in great, great detail. But, you know, for sure, they abolished slavery and they stopped all the mischief that the colonial powers were up to in that part of the island to try to retake the colony that freed itself at the strongest link in the chains of colonialism, Napoleon's army. So the Dominican Republic, somehow, I think every people has a sort of nature to their DNA. All Haitians walk in glory for what their ancestors did, and they're always rebellious. They're always leading change in the world, even if they get stamped down. But the Dominicans have always kind of had, and again, we can't generalize because you know, Dominican Republic has had its rebellions too, but they've always had a kind of anti-Haitian discourse that's beat into kids from the beginning, you know, that sort of black is bad, Haitian is bad, and they have been a base for Contras, for Haitian Contras, back in the 2004 coup.
They permitted the armed men to come in and chase Aristide out with the help of Colin Powell.
They were making raids across the border from the Dominican Republic. And the Dominican army is no slouch, huh? They're very close to the Pentagon. They're, you know, they have a couple of border forces, one called CES Front and another called, I forget the names exactly, but CES Front is basically a joint Pentagon-Dominican military. So, you know, it wasn't a negligence. They were clearly looking the other way and allowing these Haitian terrorists to come across the border and carry out acts of sabotage and destruction and killing and murder.
So it's a handy tool for the U.S.
Right, against people under Aristide's regime. So, so the Dominican Republic has... but at the same time, I do want to say, you know, there are very solid Dominican organizations, revolutionary organizations, leftist organizations, which are fighting it, standing up for Haitians being persecuted in the country. And you know,
I can remember there was a coup, a struggle, and Lyndon Johnson sent the Marines to fight a former Dominican army officer.
Well, you beat me to the punch. I mean, that was just it. you know, in 1965, U.S. Marines using the OAS as cover then, I don't think they'll be able to get the OAS to sign off on this latest intervention they want to do, but the in 1965 they did that. And in the streets of Santo Domingo, if anybody goes to Santo Domingo, you have El Conde, which is an area downtown in the historic district, the colonial zone, Zona Colonial, they call it, where they were fighting door to door. And I worked for many years with a woman who was Haitian but grew up in Dominican Republic, and she described the fighting as Haitians and Dominicans fought against the Marines and against the OAS force door to door in downtown Santo Domingo. So, you know, Caimano was the great leader who tried to reestablish the, you know, tried to do a Fidel-like 26th of July type movement in Dominican Republic. He did not succeed. So it's not to say, I don't want to paint too broad a brush of Dominicans as being reactionaries, but I'm just saying, you know, their governments there have been captured in many cases.
A checkered history. But I'm really glad we talked about that aspect of it. And again, it's Kim Ayers. And lastly, shouldn't we in Canada be asking, why isn't, first of all, it settled by a democratic process run by Haitians? Keep ourselves out of this for once. And then the other thing is, if there's going to be discussion, how about it being regional? I'm not hearing the names of Caribbean states, but there are many outstanding leaders there in the Caribbean quite capable of assisting in a peaceful resolution.
Yeah. Well, I think they are trying to woo Jamaica, I've heard, and Bahamas, that both apparently expressed their willingness. We at Haiti Liberté wrote a letter to the head of ALBA, Sasha Lorente, who we asked him to please intervene with CARICOM to convince them not to take part in any way in this U.S.-Canadian effort to send troops into Haiti. So hopefully that made some impact and was heard. But in any case, I think that we can say the CARICOM countries have become much more, I would say, clear about the important role of Haiti. Back in 2003, it was Aristide was by himself when he demanded reparations and restitutions from France for their for its colonial crimes. And today, it's all of CARICOM, which is demanding the same thing from its former colonies.
And Barbados is leading the way.
And Barbados is leading the way. So there we have, you know, again, Haiti leading the charge. You know, I think CARICOM hopefully is going to keep defending Haiti's back, as it were.
Yeah. Well, Kim Ives, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. And we're all in your debt, in my opinion. I thought that your talk at the United Nations is going to be one of the most memorable, certainly of modern times. So thank you very, very much for talking to us.
Phil, you're making me blush here. But, really, thanks a lot, and I'm glad to make your acquaintance. I read up on who was Phil Taylor, and I'm very impressed with your experience and heard at least the latest program, which was very good. So thank you very much, hopefully we'll be talking again.
I sure hope so. Thank you very much, Kim Ives. Okay, bye-bye.